This is the BBC World Service, and I'm Linda Presley, exploring the story and legacy of Pablo Escobar, Colombia's most notorious drug trafficker. There's dusty concrete, fallen bricks. So this building has now been taken apart by people who thought they might find some money here.
That's right. They ripped the toilets, sinks, cabinets, everywhere, hoping to find millions. It was common. Back in the days, they would put $1 million behind a breakfast bar or anywhere.
Camilo Uribe of Medellin City Services, a tour operator in the city, is my guide around the crumbling, abandoned six-story Monaco building, home to Pablo Escobar, his family and an army of bodyguards in the 1980s. So we're going down into the basement now.
Exactly, yes.
It's dark.
Same thing, one floor.
There's bars everywhere down here. It was clearly a system of cells, like a small jail. Yeah. It's a proper solid cell door here. And inside there's just a abandoned, damp old sacks on a crumbly floor. And what's the story about this place, Camilo?
I heard Pablo would come down here, even though he was playing with his kids up in the penthouse. He could come down here and take care of business, chop somebody's arms, legs, if they wouldn't cooperate.
Gosh, it's absolutely chilling.
You feel that, don't you? It feels...
People were killed down here.
Correct.
Most people were moving drugs up in suitcases. He industrialized it. He and the Ochoa brothers, they set up, first of all, an air bridge from Bolivia and from Peru, bringing in tons and tons of coca base.
Jeremy McDermott from Insight Crime, an investigative think tank covering organised crime in Latin America, on how Pablo Escobar revolutionised the cocaine trade in the 1970s.
They set up industrial mega laboratories in the south of Colombia. Then they continued flying, refuelled in the Caribbean, and they hit the US. They were moving tens of tons every month. And as the business grew under Escobar, and this unthinkable amounts of money began to come in, he's also developing very powerful structures. Structures of corruption within the highest ranks of government and the security forces and the police. And he's developing his own armed wing. And they're called sicarios. The word sicario is now used throughout Latin America to mean hitman.
And until Escobar's death in 1993, those hitmen turned Medellin into the murder capital of the world. Ana Cristina Restrepo is a columnist for El Colombiano and El Espectador newspapers.
It was very normal. You know, when you arrive to university on Monday, you find that one of your classmates was injured in a bomb or he was killed. Actually, one of my best friends, she was killed in a bomb. So it was a very difficult time. You know, just being alive was like a miracle.
Pablo Escobar's success as leader of the Medellin cartel was based on a simple maxim: plata or plomo, cash or a bullet. If he couldn't bribe you, he would kill you. So what traces has he left, this ruthless murderer who almost brought the Colombian state to its knees? In some quarters, and especially in Medellin's poorer barrios, there's a lingering admiration for the man who made it onto Forbes' list of billionaires.
Many people adore him. Still, if you see taxis, you can see a sticker with the face of Pablo Escobar.
And I've seen a bus with a sticker
as well.
Oh, have
you? Have you? Yeah. You see whether Jesus Christ, Virgin Mary or Pablo Escobar. So those are like the icons.
Climbing up, up, up one of the hillsides from the valley in Medellin, and there's a light green wall, and written in dark blue letters, Bienvenidos al barrio Pablo Escobar. Welcome to the barrio Pablo Escobar. And then there are two like stencil pictures of him. And underneath it says, aquí se respira paz. Here, one breathes peace. 3 decades ago, many of the families who have homes here lived in shacks on the city's municipal rubbish tip. It was Pablo Escobar who founded and built this community, part of an attempt to reinvent himself as a respectable mainstream politician. He was elected first to Medellin's city council, and then in 1982 became a substitute congressman in the national parliament.
Buenas tardes. Usted, Doña Irene.
Irene Gaviria de Flores and her husband Francisco have been married for nearly 7 decades and lived in their sturdy, spacious home for 3. In a carved wooden box, Irene keeps mementos, including photos of Pablo Escobar.
Aquí está el primer año, la fiesta que se hizo del primer año de muerto.
Okay, so this is another picture. This is the first year after he died, yeah? And so there was a parade in the street here, and all of the women are wearing dark clothes with white sashes. They're carrying a banner which says, to the memory of a noble man. When you look at this picture now, how do you feel?
I feel happy to have the picture, but sad because he's no longer with us.
In her front room, Irene's faith is writ large. A poster of a tearful, bleeding Christ dominates one wall, and there are cherubs galore. I ask her if she's troubled by the stories about Escobar, a man who, by some estimates, was responsible for the death of up to 5,000 people.
I wasn't a witness to any of that, but someone who was persecuted for 10 years probably did a lot of things. I wasn't a witness.
What about the money that Pablo Escobar had and gave to the community? Where did you believe that that came from?
We didn't know where he got his money. Who knows where someone gets his money?
Because they say he was the biggest drug trafficker ever.
I didn't see anything. Who can tell? All I can say is that he was nice. He was friendly. He was a person who helped others. He had all the good qualities. At that time, nobody else built houses to give to people. Now the government is constructing homes. It was Pablo Escobar who set the example.
At well-attended events, he inaugurated soccer pitches. He funded schools and healthcare, bought Christmas presents for children. But in the early 1980s, his double life as a politician and Colombia's most powerful narco began to unravel. There was talk of implementing an extradition agreement with the United States for drug traffickers, something Escobar feared more than anything. In 1983, the Justice Minister denounced him in Congress, together with the corruption and violence caused by the burgeoning cocaine trade. For speaking out against Escobar, Rodrigo Lara Bonilla would pay with his life, gunned down by a sicario riding pillion on a motorcycle on April the 30th, 1984. It was the beginning of Escobar's war against extradition and the state. He would never again be legitimate. On a petrol station forecourt overlooking Medellin, Luz Maria Escobar, Pablo's sister, tiny and round, steps out of a silver Hilux pickup. It's an incongruous place to meet, but these days she doesn't like to attract attention. She tells me how, 30 years ago, the assassination of the Minister of Justice was a wake-up call.
Ese día fue para mí mortal.
That day was awful for me. That's when I knew what Pablo was involved in and what was waiting for us.
And did you talk to him about it? Did you try and persuade him into a different life?
Yo siempre acompañaba a mi madre y muchas veces...
I always went with my mother and we often went looking for him. We spoke to him when there were so many massacres, but he said, well, he was able to convince you the other way. After my father was kidnapped, Pablo said to me, it's either them or us. But I just didn't think it would all go so far.
The men responsible for the kidnapping of Escobar Sr. had signed their own death warrants. They were hunted down and disposed of. But with the assassination of the Minister of Justice, Escobar had crossed a line. Luis Ospina was a Medellin teenager in 1984.
Colombia had been a violent country, but nobody just went about killing ministers. And from then on, till 1993, when Escobar died, those 9 years were pretty tough, and especially for us here in Medellin, because that was where the psychopath lived. People complex too much about Escobar. You have to see it very simply. This person was a psychopath with too much money.
Luis's father, Alfonso Ospina, had been a member of cabinet in the government of Belisario Betancourt, the president who'd reignited the extradition issue. On the morning of the 15th of November 1988, Senator Ospina got into his car as normal.
It had been a long weekend, and he left for the office at his usual hour, and he was intercepted by two or three cars with guns very near the house, and he was taken to this farm of Escobar. These Castaños, which were the main paramilitaries that had been in Colombia ever, they kidnapped him because he didn't want to contribute to their cause. Their cause was more violence, more death, more guns.
The Castaños were working for the Medellin cartel, for Pablo Escobar.
Yeah, they were closely knit back then. And my family were sure that Escobar was happily helping with this kidnapping because he knew that my father belonged to that government which reignited the extradition.
As the negotiations with his father's abductors continued, and fearing another kidnap, Luis, his mother and siblings, went into exile.
The heaviest thing was to think that you wouldn't be able to come back ever, because that's what we really wished. We love this country. There was a lot of despair back then because we didn't see a solution at the end of the tunnel, and most of Colombians didn't. So being exiled, we were thinking we're never going to be able to come back. It was something you'll never forget in your life.
Luis and his family did return to Medellin, but his father, Alfonso Ospina, never came home. He was killed in captivity.
We even had to pay ransom for the body. That was how bad things were here. And the contact to do this was a person who had been a friend of my father's and who worked for Escobar now.
So Escobar just bought everybody?
Most of everybody. We had to ask him to give us the body. And he asked for money, and because he said it was for the kidnappers because of all the logistics.
In working-class communities of the city, where Escobar found and trained his young sicarios, whole families pledged allegiance to the Medellin cartel. Two decades on, Felipe Mejia, a social science teacher, says where he lives, people made a lot of money.
A lot of what they have now is because they were able to get it then, because they were trafficking drugs for Escobar. They had a higher status in the barrio because they worked for him, got cash from him, and were with him.
In 1989, Felipe was just 10. His older brother, Jaime, was 18, in his last year of high school, with plans to join the Air Force. On the 28th of April, Jaime went out to a friend's house.
Some people came to the house asking for him and passing themselves off as detectives. They said they had to take him because he was a suspect. They took him away in a car. 2 hours later, his body was found. My dad told the authorities.
So they thought that your brother was with one of the rival cartels?
Yes, but not just my brother. The whole family were mistakenly linked with the Cali cartel. And this was an era in Medellin when anyone identified with the Cali cartel was simply assassinated. I looked to my parents for reassurance and security, but they didn't feel secure or calm. For 8 months after my brother was killed, we all slept in the same bedroom with the mattresses on the floor, because my parents said, if they want to kill us, they can kill us all together.
In 1991, after a bloody campaign that took out politicians, police officers, judges and journalists, and even a commercial airliner, the government capitulated. Colombia banned extradition. Pablo Escobar surrendered. In an elaborate charade, he was incarcerated on a tropical Andean peak overlooking the city of Medellin.
So we're just going into the site, La Catedral. This is the place where Pablo Escobar built his own luxury prison. And as you come in, down a rough pathway, what you see now are two huge crosses, because this has now been taken over by a community of Benedictine monks who have actually turned it into an old people's home. Just on the gate here, there's a sign, "No guns, please." I went with Juan Ignacio Garcia, a local journalist and our translator.
A lot of people came up here to dig, to find any kind of money or treasures that Pablo Escobar and his people could have buried there.
Because I read a story that he used to get the money delivered, tight rolls of $100 notes would come up in milk cans.
The stories, some of them are so incredible that you don't know how to grasp those facts, but at the same time you tend to believe all the stories because that was Pablo Escobar.
And there's a sign here on a path that says this is the ruins of what was one of the rooms of pleasure with the round vibrating bed of Señor Pablo Emilio Escobar Gaviria. He could more or less look right down onto the valley, right over his terrain.
Exactly, and supposedly he chose this place because surrounded by mountains and also pretty cloudy. So it was difficult to have some kind of airstrike or air support for any operation.
On the edge of the site, there's a helicopter pad terraced into the hillside here. I wonder how many times Pablo Escobar came and went by helicopter. What we do know about him is that apparently the Christmas he was supposed to be in prison, he spent it in a nightclub down in the valley. And on his 41st birthday here, he gave an enormous party. The guests were served salmon and caviar. He even hosted a wedding reception for some friends up here when he was in this, what was supposed to be, a high-security prison. But it wasn't the parties and prostitutes, the guns and games of soccer starring players from the national team that would be his undoing.
I didn't realize a lot of things back then, but Pablo had a tight rein on the cartel. And after 5 p.m., that's when the criminals working for him used to visit. Of course, nobody stopped them coming in because he was paying the guards.
This man was a regular visitor, a lawyer acting for one of the other prisoners detained with El Patron. Even now, this lawyer believes it's too dangerous to be identified, so his words are spoken by someone else.
Pablo Escobar was a very disconcerting person. He seemed well-educated. He didn't swear, and he was friendly with the lawyers. It wasn't like being with one of the most notorious criminals in the world. Normally, I didn't see his other associates, but one day, when I was there, so was Gerardo Moncada. I greeted him. Now, I know that was just a few hours before Moncada and Fernando Galeano were murdered.
Escobar had invited both men, important players in the cartel, to visit him at La Catedral, but he believed they'd cheated him in a drugs deal.
They never found their bodies. Some say they were burned, but they couldn't find anything.
It was July 1992. An embarrassed and exasperated government was forced to act and moved to transfer Escobar to a real jail. He escaped. The manhunt gripped the nation, and hundreds more would die before he was tracked to a house in downtown Medellin on December the 2nd, 1993.
This is the spot where Pablo was hiding, and eventually this is where he got killed on a rooftop. There used to be a house, but it's nothing but a wall there, which is graffiti.
Well, I'm with Camilo Uribe, and as Camilo says, now the house is gone. It's a very ordinary street. There's a red spotty parasol on the terrace of one of the neighbouring flats, and people just going up and down about their business.
The journalists who went there and the photographers, we couldn't believe it. We couldn't believe it because he was like a legend.
Journalist Ana Cristina Restrepo.
It was very hard to believe that he was dead. Also, he was looking quite different. He was quite fat, fatter than normal.
there was heavy rain, and it was, the river of the Medellin was as big as I had ever seen it in my life. It was about to inundate the whole city, and the water was dirty, and I felt this energy. It was a torrent of badness in that river, and it was going, it was moving. Something I connect with this finishing of Escobar.
Footage of the funeral shows a heaving tumult of people, a scramble to touch the coffin. Irene was there.
Mucha gente, no cabía la gente. Horrible.
There were so many people at the funeral. A lot of people. A lot of tears. A lot of pain. It was horrible. But I don't think he's dead. And if he's alive, I hope God is keeping him well.
Sometimes I believe it was not him.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes I believe it was not him. But, you know, he had all these kind of tests and the police said that it was him, so we must believe.
But there's still something in you that thinks,
yes.
Was it?
It's not only because I didn't see that he was very alike the person that I knew in the pictures or I saw in TV. It's because we thought at that time that the nightmare was over, but it was not. You can see that his spirit is alive. That's a very scary thought, thinking that he could be alive still.
The poor neighborhoods and parts of Medellin city center are still in the hands of criminals. That is the totally negative legacy of Pablo Escobar.
And that's the nightmare that isn't over, according to the lawyer who used to visit La Catedral. Over the last two decades, the murder rate in Medellin has fallen dramatically, but not consistently, and the city still struggles to contain the violence.
The criminal groups have transformed themselves. They don't use terrorism like Escobar. They use selective assassinations. But they are still trafficking drugs, and extortion is big business. If you talk to people, they tell you they have to pay protection money. So you might see a nice, apparently peaceful city now. But there is a lot of stuff going on.
Medellin was recently voted the world's most innovative city. In some of the poorest neighborhoods, vast libraries have been built and a sophisticated transport network reaches out to the most marginalized areas with the intention of including the excluded. As a visitor, it feels very safe. But as she moves around her city, Ana Cristina Restrepo clocks something else.
If you go to a shopping mall, if you see in the streets, you will see so many women who have been having operations or changing their body.
It's what's been called the narco aesthetic, and Ana Cristina relates it directly to the way Pablo Escobar viewed and exploited women.
If the girl is not pretty enough, she has to change her body according to what the man wants. So that's why in Medellin it's very common to have plastic surgeries, especially bum and breasts, especially what they want to change.
And so a lot of his girlfriends had surgery, did they, in the 80s?
Yes, of his lovers. Not his formal wife, but his lovers were like that.
And how do we see that now here in Medellin?
You see it everywhere in every social class. But you don't know really if they are linked to drug dealers or it's just because they like it, because they have seen that since 25 years ago.
Because it's part of popular culture.
Exactly.
Popular culture has forged a whole Pablo Escobar industry. There are tours and t-shirts, books about him are bestsellers. And a TV series about his life, El Patron del Mal, The Boss of Evil, secured some of the highest audiences ever in Colombia. This fascination is part of what many see as a toxic legacy.
Every day I think of all those people who, in one way or another, suffered or are suffering because of my brother, because of the war he fought here in Medellin, in Colombia.
This is Luz Maria, Pablo Escobar's sister. But she's conflicted. She'll also tell you he was an excellent brother. Still, she's been public about saying sorry. And she does something I've never come across before. She leaves notes on the graves of her brother's victims.
así como le escribo a mi mamá.
Simply, it's just as if I was writing to my mother, little notes, like I tried to my brother, that I'd leave there in the graveyard.
And what did you say on the note?
Yo pedía perdón.
I just asked for forgiveness.
I asked Felipe Mejia, the teacher whose teenage brother was killed by members of Escobar's Medellin cartel, what he thinks about Luz María's notes.
If one of those notes appeared on my brother's grave, I don't think I'd care much. I'd probably throw it in the bin, because just an apology for what happened isn't enough. It's a question of justice. The guys who killed my brother, some are still alive. They have fulfilled lives. They've got children and grandchildren, and... And I don't have my brother.
Killings and disappearances are still part of Colombia's reality, although those extraordinary levels of violence have diminished. But Felipe says people have yet to face the truth about Pablo Escobar.
Como nuestros vecinos se convertían en nuestros propios asesinos.
Where we live, our neighbors turn into our assassins. We have to put an end to this forgetting, this amnesia. We must remember so that it doesn't happen again.